It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is day two of a federal government shutdown, and a range of federal services and programs may soon be impacted here in Wisconsin.
Yesterday afternoon, we spoke with Wisconsin's Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin between votes to get the latest on negotiations with Republicans and what the shutdown means for people here in our state. Nearly 18,000 civilian federal workers are based here.
I start by asking Baldwin about why Democrats won't vote in favor of a stopgap funding bill to reopen the government and negotiate separately with Republicans about extending Affordable Care Act tax credits before they expire at the end of the year.
We have an imminent issue with the cost of health care predicted to literally double if Congress doesn't act, and Congress doesn't act expeditiously. And Senator Thune has insisted on pressing forward with a resolution that had no Democratic input. And we've seen a lot of handshakes and promises that haven't come to fruition. We have got to reopen the government and extend the premium tax credits so that people can continue to afford their health care. And this is, again, any day now, Wisconsinites are going to receive letters informing them that their health insurance prices have nearly doubled. And that can only be averted if Congress acts.
Okay, so these stopgap bills, they need 60 votes to pass. Hypothetically, if Republicans were to agree to extend these health care tax credits past the end of the year, would you then support this funding bill?
I would like to accomplish both of those. So, yes, the whole idea here is to keep the government open or reopen the government. That's something that I have voted to do repeatedly with the Democratic resolution that includes addressing the health care crisis that we have right now. That's exactly what I want to accomplish.
Are there any other sticking points beyond the tax subsidies and beyond what has happened in the tax and spending law?
Look, there are always a range of issues, and I'm pressing forward as a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee in trying to pass our bills funding the agencies so that we're not going from continuing resolution to continuing resolution, something that I'm pressing for and discussing every day with Republicans, where we can deal with a whole range of issues. But right now, with the nearing window for people to select insurance for next year through the Affordable Care Act marketplace, we have really a crisis situation, and we must address it expeditiously, or people will all people will see their healthcare costs go up.
Democrats do face criticism within their own party for not pushing back harder against the policies of the Trump administration, and that the party being plagued by fragmented strategy, misplaced priorities has been a criticism. Is this moment, the government shutdown, the answer to this criticism?
Look, one of the huge problems with this administration has been their lawlessness. We have seen any number of actions where the president has completely disregarded the law, disregarded the directives in our appropriations measures that have been signed into law. And so I think the accountability question is a huge question on everyone's mind. But right now, again, the costs are probably the number one issue on everyone's mind. And this president actually ran for office promising to bring down costs across the board, whether that be groceries, health care, housing, child care. And we have seen everything go up because of his policies. And so this is the fight. And right now, the centerpiece is healthcare, because we know that we're expecting dramatic increases in prices. The Kaiser Family Foundation just yesterday predicted that on average, people's healthcare costs would go up 114%. That's extraordinary. But if Congress acts, we can avert some of that harm.
But Senator Baldwin, federal workers' jobs are on the line this time. They could be fired, not just furloughed. Does that change your political calculus?
Look, first of all, I worked hard to avoid a shutdown, and I am continuing to work to find a bipartisan path forward. This president and his OMB director have lawlessly fired people. He fired probationary employees. He's had reduction in force. He's had the buyouts. We've seen this harm since day one. We need to do everything we can to reopen the government and keep people's health care costs from skyrocketing. That is, and there's an easy path forward. President Trump and Republicans should come to the table, start negotiating now about how we can protect millions upon millions of Americans from seeing these shocking price increases.
Are there any good faith negotiations happening in the present now on the Hill?
I'm talking daily with my Republican colleagues. I know a number of them who want to get this done. And it makes it even more frustrating that the president and the Speaker of the House don't want to negotiate and want to stubbornly push through something that is completely written by Republicans without any Democratic input. Many of my Republican colleagues in the United States Senate recognize that the Senate only works in a bipartisan fashion. And so I've talked to a number of them who want to extend these tax credits. I feel like almost without question, the votes are there in the United States Senate to extend these tax cuts. But the president and the Speaker of the House have to get serious about speaking with us. You know, it's notable that the House is not even in session this week. Democrats showed up to do their job, but the Republican speaker said they're not coming back into session until next week. They're clearly not serious about trying to reopen the government. We're the ones working tirelessly, reaching out to our Republican colleagues to try to get that done.
We're talking with Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, looking at this federal government shutdown as President Trump and Congress have failed to reach a deal. Here in Wisconsin, we talked with the head of Wisconsin's Department of Children and Families, Jeff Pirtle, who said that they have a solid month where they can keep things going. But after that, he said it's going to vary a lot from program to program. What is your message to states like Wisconsin that are trying to deliver these federal programs without interruption?
Yes. So imagine the crisis that we will have when children and families can no longer afford their health care. I think that this fight to make sure that we don't see millions of Americans lose health care because of unaffordability and the rest struggle with price increases that they can hardly afford is a really important and timely fight to have. And we want to reopen the government and assure that people can continue to afford their health care.
Are there stopgap measures, though, at the state level for state government in the midst of a federal crisis?
The state, I work closely with state officials on areas in which we partner. Mm-hmm. And I'm working very hard to reopen the government. And that is exactly what we need to do. But again, the only path forward in the Senate is to do so in a bipartisan manner. And as long as the president and the speaker refuse to negotiate, we are going to keep on fighting to reopen the government and to make sure that people can afford their health care.
As we close here, Senator Baldwin, shutdowns damage people's lives, especially for the thousands of Wisconsinites who are civilian federal employees. What will you do to help repair their lives and make Wisconsinites whole in these times?
I'm very mindful of what happens during a shutdown, and I'm also very mindful about what happens when people lose their ability to have insurance coverage. I've been holding roundtables throughout the state of Wisconsin, and people are terrified about what the neglect of this issue will mean for their lives. And therefore, we've got to do both. We've got to reopen the government and assure that the tax credits for the Affordable Care Act and are restored so that we don't see this doubling in cost for health care. And again, this is going to hurt everyone, not just those who are on the Affordable Care Act marketplace. This is critical. And we have to also assure that as soon as we're able to reopen the government, that those workers are paid, as has happened in every other shutdown in the past.
Senator Baldwin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That is Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. We spoke yesterday afternoon about the federal government shutdown. We also have an invitation out to Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson for his response to the shutdown. You can find more reporting and how the government shutdown affects people here in Wisconsin at WPR.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, for centuries, tribes along the shores of Lake Superior used fire to help manage forests. Now the practice is returning to Wisconsin Point, and ecologist talks about the significance of a cultural prescribed burn.
The best way to protect something is not always to just leave it be.
The ancient practice of Ishkode, or good fire in Ojibwe, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For centuries, indigenous tribes along the shores of Lake Superior used fire to help manage the lands and forests. The Ojibwe people call it Ishkode, or good fire. This powerful ancient practice was passed down through generations of Anishinaabe people.
Now, after years of research and advocacy, the practice of a cultural prescribed burn is returning to Wisconsin Point. That's a freshwater sandbar and wildlife preserve in Superior.
Evan Larson is chair of UW-Platteville's Department of Environmental Sciences and Society. In collaboration with local tribes, he studied fire ecology in the region for more than two decades, and he recently published new research about indigenous fire management and co-authored a children's book called Ishkode, A Story of Fire. Evan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
Okay, there was a test burn that had been scheduled for September at Wisconsin Point, this freshwater sandbar in Superior. Can you tell us what's the latest on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a wonderful example of how when you're working with fire, you're really working with fire, and you don't get to dictate. So weather conditions, it's been so wet this fall that it's been a long time to get just the right conditions. As of now, it looks like possibly yet this week, so maybe that first week transition into October, or really soon thereafter. Fuel conditions are ready. The partnerships are all getting formalized and the last signatures are coming together. And so hopefully any day now we'll see smoke coming up from Wisconsin Point.
Wow. And Wisconsin Johnson Point, this is the long natural sandbar in Superior that divides Alloway Bay from Lake Superior. Can you describe the red pines and the vegetation there?
Oh, it's just beautiful. There's trails all throughout the end of the point and some great parking areas. It's a very accessible space. And when you get out onto those paths and you have that really soft feel of pine needles under your feet and the smell, especially when the sun's out, the pines that are towering over the road, you're almost driving through a cathedral there. Those are 200 plus years old. And a lot of them kind of carry the story of fire in their trunks and fire scars. And that was part of the really kind of beautiful entry into this story for a lot of us.
How do these trees tell stories through their rings? Their rings go back centuries.
Yeah. And so a lot of people, you know, if you see a stump, it's almost this tangible, you reach out and you want to touch it, and you can see those rings and you can count them back and see, you know, what year were you born, or some of those big events in our lives. And to know that every year the trees out on Wisconsin Point have been laying on another ring, and that that ring is very much a story of the conditions that they lived in that year. Was it a wet year? Was it dry? Was there a windstorm? And in the case of some years, was there a fire? And when that fire passes by, if enough heat works through the bark of these trees, and they're really resistant to fire, but if enough heat moves through that bark, it can cause a scar. And then what the tree will start to do is heal around that scar. But the actual sign of the injury is then filled with resin. And that's a response by the tree to just protect itself. And then is almost permanently laid down. Some of the fire scars that we were looking at in old stumps from trees that have been dead for decades, the scars were formed in the 1700s in some cases. So they're hundreds of years old. And yet still, you polish them up and you look at them under a microscope and you can see the individual cells still. And that story of fire has been carried in the bodies of those trees for all these years.
And these are cultural prescribed burns in the context of Ojibwe culture and the word Ishkode. Can you explain how these good fires are part of your research and a part of your work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that it's just so important to recognize that when we're working with these trees, you know, they're rooted to place. And so the stories in their rings are emergent from that place specifically. And so the history of the Anishinaabe, all through the Great Lakes, there's a lot of movement and there's a lot of hardship and there's a lot of really dramatic impacts from government policies and acts of removal. And so for communities whose knowledge and understanding was shared through stories for all this time, it's a really kind of powerful experience to recognize that in the case of the trees on Wisconsin Point, the stories of fires that they're carrying in their rings are literally the stories of the people, and that through all of the trauma and all the years of real hardship, that those trees have been rooted to that place and are carrying that story. And that the work that some incredible students and my amazing collaborators and I were able to do is help bring those stories back out to people today.
And can you make that connection, how fires that burned across Wisconsin Point in the 1700s and the early 1800s, how those fires inform a prescribed burn today?
One of the amazing things that you can learn from trees is not just when a fire occurred, but you can actually see the season of when that fire occurred. And so a lot of the fire scars that were recorded out on Wisconsin Point are recorded in the later part of the growth ring of that year. And so that's telling us that they're kind of late summer or early fall burns. And there's so many stories about how important these areas were for blueberry gathering and all sorts of other really important medicines and culturally significant plants. And there are a lot of stories about going and picking blueberries and then setting a fire to that little pocket of blueberries as the people left, because blueberries, much like the red pine, really thrive in the presence of fire. It rejuvenates them. They'll grow more berries. It helps them kind of maintain a robust presence in that place. And so linking the tree ring data with the traditional stories of the timing of burns really made that connection really strong. And then the other piece that was really interesting in our research, you know, because how do you know there were people setting fires and there weren't fires caused by lightning? And that's mm-hmm. a really important question for a lot of people. And so, you know, there are stories, and certainly those stories tell us that the people were setting fire. But if you need more than that, you know, we looked at the Fire Atlas data that's been maintained by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. It goes back decades, and over about 500,000 acres surrounding kind of northern Wisconsin and Wisconsin Point, there were just a few fires that were caused by lightning recorded. And so if you compare the frequency of fires caused by lightning today compared to the frequency of fires that was recorded in the tree ring record, it cannot explain the patterns that we see in the record and on the land. And so in that context, you know, that's enough. But then even further is that once treaties were signed that further dislocated the Ojibwe from Wisconsin Point, the fire stopped. And so we know that lightning did not sign those treaties.
Right.
And so again, that's a really, really powerful line of evidence that those were fires that were set by people who were living in relationship with that landscape.
And going back to Wisconsin Point and how fires really call the shots in some respects with these cultural prescribed burns. Evan, you have just recently returned from going to Burn Boss Academy, this intensive course where you get certified to plan and execute these burns. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what happened there and what you learned?
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. So the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, who some of you might be aware of, have been working for years to organize a certification program to help make sure that the people in Wisconsin who are looking for ways to engage with their landscape through fire can do so really safely and effectively. And I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of years of experience among the instructors for this incredibly intensive workshop-based approach to the training, where we were going 14 hours a day, all fire, all the time. Amazing group work, amazing instructors, so reflective and so much knowledge, but really getting together to make sure that there is a community of people who are really proactively engaging with fire in the landscape. And the reason that's so important is, you know, there is the Forest Service. We have the DNR, and they're doing really good and important work with fire, and increasingly so. But the vast majority of land in Wisconsin is privately owned. And so when you look at how much land we need to burn per year to sustain this incredibly rich and beautiful biodiversity of our state, it's never going to be a thing that government agencies can solve. It has to come to people, the people who are living on the land. And so certainly private landowners in Wisconsin stand to benefit from this knowledge because their lands will benefit. Certainly there's reason to work really hard to make sure that we're supporting efforts for the indigenous communities of Wisconsin to really be able to practice their traditional land tending practices in a way that honors both the history of the place as well as their culture and their relationship with fire. And so they're all parts of the bigger solution. And that's a way to, you know, live on this landscape and support the parts of it that I think so many of us just love and really want to celebrate.
We're talking about the science and history of prescribed burns as the practice returns to northern Wisconsin in Wisconsin Point. Evan Larson is professor and chair of UW-Platteville's Department of Environmental Sciences and Society and stays with us. Evan, you co-wrote this new children's book about prescribed burns. It's called Ishkode, A Story of Fire. What was it like to translate your research and your livelihood for an audience of young readers?
Oh, it was just magical. This story emerged through years of collaboration. And so, so many people have contributed to the work that is now expressed in that book. Connecting with Miri Villiard, just an incredible artist who's a Fond du Lac Band direct descendant. collaborating really closely with Nisse Ogabekwe and Melanie Montano, an enrolled member of the Red Cliff Band of Ojibwe. And what we really felt inspired to do is make sure that this lesson helps get to the folks who need to hear it. We can publish scientific papers, and those are really useful and important, but so much of the work around fire is really about our culture. And, growing up, as many of us have, we, hear Smokey Bear, we've seen the movie Bambi, and we build this like fear and knowledge of fire, this terrible and destructive thing. And there's no space for it to be good and beautiful and quiet and peaceful. And that starts from a very early age. And so when we wrote this book, there was just this picture we had of a caregiver, a grandma or a parent or someone who loves a child and sitting with that child in their lap and turning the pages and reading the story out loud, because then it's not just written, but it's spoken to. And to have somebody come into life and their first understanding of, fire is something to be respected. It's something to be careful around and with, but it doesn't have to have that same kind of dangerous and damaging and almost evil perspective that a lot of times we characterize fire with. And so, yeah, it's helping to build that culture from the very start.
For me, one of the most striking moments in the book is when white settlers clear-cut the forest, taking away these trees that are absolutely precious to the indigenous communities in Wisconsin Point. And, I'm just wondering what can happen when people who aren't in tune with Wisconsin forests and these trees, they take control of the rhythms of the trees and take control of their destiny.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I usually cry when I'm reading that part of the story. Mm. Just kidding. Anyway, I think Miri's illustrations are just so beautiful. And she's showing there's not evil intent, but there's just a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding. And I think that, a lot of people who are listening, maybe they've read the book Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Kimmerer. And, that idea that she so beautifully illustrates with sweetgrass that, if you abuse or overuse this plant, this relative, then, it'll go away. But it'll go away if you ignore it too, and the importance of that balanced relationship. And what became just so clear through all of this work is that, that relationship, that reciprocity, it is just as relevant between people and pines as it is between people and sweetgrass. So I think that's kind of at the heart of this message, is that, we have impacts and relationships and responsibilities across the landscape, and that sometimes we don't even really recognize them just because of the way the history has played out. But it's never too late to learn about that and to start picking up those responsibilities again. And you just have to be open to learning.
I had no idea the connection to blueberries for Wisconsin Point and the importance of Minan in Anishinaabe. And can you tell us the story of blueberries?
Well, I can share some stories that have been shared with us.
Yeah.
And just knowing, that there's so many stories and it's so important. But one of the elders at Fond du Lac that we worked with early in this, we were talking about Minnesota Point and Wisconsin Point, because the story is relevant for both landforms. And he shared this kind of memory of a story of the whole point just lined with canoes. And, the youngest kids are splashing and playing in the waters of Lake Superior, and the rest of the family is just on the point harvesting. And another elder shared a story about, this memory of like sitting down and just as far as the eye could see, just blueberries. And I think that the abundance of that landscape is so far in the past that we have a really hard time conceptualizing what it looked like. And that shift, it's this shifting ecological baseline syndrome might be a way you could describe it, where we're so used to seeing the land as it is, it's really hard to imagine what it was. And so this burn on Wisconsin Point, it represents so many things. It represents sovereignty. It represents responsibility and reciprocity. engagement, but it also represents a really active effort to create the vision and the world that could be. And I think that in a way that's, you know, kind of the most important and powerful piece of all of this, is that we're changing the way we think about how we can relate to the land. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe the really key piece here is that it's helping people recognize that we can have a really positive and constructive impact on the landscape, and that the things that people do, they don't always have to be negative. And I think that that's really important, to have that emotional space to recognize that we're actually a really valuable and important contributor. The best way to protect something is not always to just leave it be.
Where is the research headed next, and how are local tribes staying involved?
It's so much fun to see this work, because it's like there was this energy built up, this pent up energy, and you just see efforts emerging across the region. There's conversations happening at Red Cliff, at Bad River, at Fond du Lac, at Grand Portage, Leech Lake and Red Lake and White Earth, the Menominee Reservation, all of these places. You can see a resurgence of fire as a key cultural part of how people live and interact with the land. You know, it was a little spark in a lot of dry tinder. And to be very clear, you know, this is not the first project that is doing this, and certainly we are not the first to advocate for this. But it's just been really powerful to see the response. It has absolutely made community happen, and that's a really beautiful thing.
Evan, thank you for sharing this research. Thank you for sharing the children's book.
Thanks so much for having me.
That is Evan Larson, chair of UW-Platteville's Department of Environmental Sciences and Society. We learned about his research and collaborations around the practice of cultural prescribed burns and his new children's book, Ishkode, A Story of Fire. It's co-authored with Melanie Montano. Cultural prescribed burns are being reintroduced to Wisconsin Point, due in part to Evan and Melanie's research and advocacy.
Coming up, it's Oktoberfest season. Visit a local festival and check out the traditions of Wisconsin's German immigrant heritage.
We have authentic German music. We have live Glockenspiel performances throughout the day. So it's a very fun atmosphere all around.
That's next here on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's Oktoberfest season. Communities around the state celebrate Wisconsin's German-American heritage with dance, music, pretzels, and beer, with festivals inspired by the original event in Munich.
Some Oktoberfests already happened in September, including big ones in La Crosse and Appleton.
But if you are looking to throw on the lederhosen and celebrate, there is still time.
Patrick Curran is executive director for Festivals of Cedarburg, hosting Oktoberfest this Saturday and Sunday. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about the history, the German history of Cedarburg, and then the Oktoberfest history there in Cedarburg?
Yeah, absolutely. So Cedarburg has strong German roots, heritage throughout, and Oktoberfest, it was originally called Germanfest, took place in the early 2000s. And then I'm the executive director of Festivals of Cedarburg, which is a nonprofit we put on Oktoberfest, Strawberry Festival, Wine and Harvest, and Winter Festival. Oktoberfest kind of came under our umbrella starting in 2008. So from 2008 onward, Oktoberfest has been a staple of Cedarburg, and obviously a highlight for both staff planning it. It's the most fun festival, but also for the local community as well.
What is fun about planning this festival in particular?
Strawberry Festival and Wine and Harvest Festival, which are a lot bigger. Typically, it's like, you know, between 90 and 110,000 people. So this festival is much more contained. It has a theme. I get to wear a lederhosen. And for the last several years, we've been blessed with some really great weather. So it's a lot slower of a pace. It's one that I can actually have a beer or two during the event, as opposed to the other larger festivals. So it's a great time. And also just all the
authentic German music. We have live Glockenspiel performances throughout the day. So it's a very fun atmosphere all around.
Right. Some people listening are old hands at going to Oktoberfest. Maybe they tour them around the state. For people who have never been to one, paint us a picture of what we're going to see and experience when we get there.
Yeah, absolutely. So we shut down in the middle of downtown Cedarburg around the City Hall community gym area. It's about 2.5 parking lots. We shut down. We have about 30 or so marketplace vendors. And then we also, throughout the day, we have obviously our main beer tent that'll have, more traditional German music. We have like Two Fifths Party Band. On Sunday, we have live Glockenspiel show. And then we have four local breweries that participate as well. So plenty of beer, traditional German food. So it's just a great atmosphere, and it's looking like the weather's going to be lovely this weekend.
I believe I saw you've got contests of various sorts.
Yeah,
at Oktoberfest.
Yeah.
What kind of things can we compete in?
Yep, absolutely. So throughout the day on Saturday, we have a variety of contests. All that is, like, the times are available on our website, but we have German spelling bee, we have German trivia, we have a pretzel toss contest, best Lederhosen dirndl, most hat pins, but the fan favorite throughout the years is Maschgrustemmen, which is the Stein holding contest. And so we have a male and female division for that. Saturday night, whoever can hold a stein full of water, because we don't want to spill a drop of beer during Oktoberfest, whoever can hold it the longest, they win a stein.
Steins can be kind of heavy.
Yeah, I'm surprised that they are able to hold them as long as they do. I certainly cannot.
Now, Patrick, I've been to a lot of block parties and festivals and things like that around Wisconsin. And when I'm just there as a spectator, it just seems like it sort of magically happens on its own. I know people who plan public events. I know it isn't magic. There's a lot of work that goes into it. Take us behind the scenes. What goes into planning an event like Oktoberfest and your other festivals in Cedarburg?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are, for most all the festivals that we put on, they're juried shows. So we have applications that go live on our website, typically early in the year, even though Oktoberfest is in October. So, we go through the process of selecting vendors. And obviously, you have all the important things like making sure there's trash cans where they need to be, and toilets and ice and beer and water, and making sure we don't run out of food, which the last couple of years we've had a lot of food sold. So it's a game with trying to predict the weather, because obviously that plays a large part in outdoor festivals, but then also making sure that we have all of our T's crossed and I's dotted.
I love going to community festivals, see the people out enjoying themselves. I've got festival friends who I run into, a few times a year at these outdoor events. What do you see as the value for Cedarburg of having Oktoberfest and other community events like that?
Absolutely. So really the main point of the festivals is to expose people to beautiful downtown Cedarburg. We hope that they come during some of these more busy weekends and then are so in love with the city that they want to come back on a maybe not so busy weekend. So, we have people that come for Strawberry Festival. We hope that they come back for, a weekend getaway in maybe January or February, when it's a little slower for a lot of the shops downtown. It's really meant to kind of advertise Cedarburg as a whole in hopes that people return on a non-festival weekend.
I know, again, from knowing festival organizers, volunteers can be key to events like this. What would you say to people, whether they're in Cedarburg or elsewhere, to say, hey, get involved, find out how you can volunteer and help out at these community events?
Absolutely. It's a major help having volunteers for some of our bigger festivals. We need about 200 to 300 different volunteers throughout the weekends. Oktoberfest is a great, local community event. You volunteer and you're pouring beer and you get to see your neighbor or somebody that lives, nearby and catch up with old friends. And it's just a great way to be involved in a community that you live in or you don't live in, while also giving back to an organization that does its best to benefit the downtown area.
What are your future hopes for Oktoberfest in Cedarburg?
So the last couple of years, we've really doubled down on our merch booth. And what we've been trying to do is collect as many vintage steins as possible in the off season. And then we sell them during the festival. And my goal is always to sell out of the steins that we accumulate throughout the year in the merch booth. But, obviously Oktoberfest, with it being a smaller festival than some of our larger ones, it's really just about making sure that it maintains a good size where it's a breath of fresh air. It's not as big as some of the larger Oktoberfests or festivals in the area, for that matter. It's just a wonderful family-friendly festival. So long-term plans is to keep it small and manageable, but also big enough where people are still able to have a great time.
You mentioned this is one where you get a little bit of time to enjoy things. What are you looking forward to at this year's event?
Absolutely. Well, we do have a wide variety of different Oktoberfests, so hopefully I can get a sample size of each of the Oktoberfests we have offered. And then, I'm a big sucker for a Hungarian brat, so I usually get a Hungarian brat platter throughout the weekend. That's located in our food court area. The guys that run the Glockenspiel, Live Cuckoo Clock, they also serve the food throughout the weekend, and they keep all the proceeds for their organization as well. So it's a great fundraiser for them.
Well, now you got me hungry and thirsty. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Patrick Curran, Executive Director for Festivals of Cedarburg, hosting Oktoberfest this Saturday and Sunday. Now, what's the story behind Wisconsin's German heritage? Jim Leary joins us now. He's a professor and folklorist at UW-Madison. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Rob.
Well, I know Germans were one of the biggest immigrant groups to Wisconsin for a lot of years in the 1800s. What was it about Wisconsin that brought so many German people here?
Well, it was an incremental movement. There had been a lot of Germans already in New York State and Pennsylvania and Philadelphia and so forth. But in the 1840s, there were transportation routes available to Wisconsin in its territorial and early statehood days. There was land and opportunity. And so those were the pull factors. And in Germany, there were the failed liberal revolutions of 1848, population explosions, some religious differences, threats of war, the usual. Mm-hmm. People wanted to find a new place, and they could get to Wisconsin. And so they came in rather large numbers pre-Civil War, and then later in the 1880s and after that up until before World War I.
We're talking about this now because it's Oktoberfest season, and a lot of immigrant groups will bring those festivals over to look back at their homelands. What led to this Oktoberfest tradition really spreading to so many communities in Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. Well, Oktoberfest was a kind of a manufactured event in the early 19th century in Munich, Germany, celebrating the wedding of Prince Ludwig. But it was also, coinciding with harvest sorts of events. And it was centered around beer. And of course, beer has been very important, as well as harvest and seasonal celebrations in Wisconsin. But big launch burgeoning of Oktoberfest in Wisconsin really was a kind of a post-World War II phenomenon. And it partly coincided with, lots of Americans having been involved in World War II and in Europe and of course in an anti-fascist capacity, but also with a sense of the country and a sense, in the case of Wisconsinites involved, of their German-American neighbors who were fighting on the American side. And in the 1950s and 60s, German communities in Wisconsin were inspired by the beer drinking and festivity that was going on in Munich. And this was an opportunity for chambers of commerce, for local taverns, restaurants, German ethnic groups here in Wisconsin to celebrate their cultural heritage with a seasonal event that typically goes on for a couple of weeks. And so they, you know, Lacrosse's festival started in 61, and we have lots and lots of them around the state ever since.
The timing there is interesting, because I know during World War I and World War II, maybe your German identity in the United States was something you would downplay. I remember seeing pictures of book burnings in Wisconsin, people burning German language books during World War I. So finally, then, in the post-war era, here's a chance, it sounds like, for people of German heritage to come out into the spotlight again and celebrate some parts of their culture after the wars were behind them.
That's absolutely right. And of course, that World War, aftermath of World War I also included Prohibition. And during World War II, I know of several polka bands that were German, but they started to call themselves the Jolly Swiss Boys or something like that, because Switzerland was a neutral country, but they could assert that. And of course, Oktoberfest goes along with beer and polka music and dancing and wearing those Bavarian hats with the little feathers on them and that sort of thing.
And this Oktoberfest is the German version of this. This is common with a lot of immigrant communities in Wisconsin, right? Having these holidays that celebrate that heritage, whether, you know, this generation immigrated or the six generations ago immigrated.
Yeah, and because of the proliferation or the presence of many indigenous and immigrant peoples in Wisconsin, there always has been a kind of pluralism, and some have thought of Wisconsin as a state where Gemütlichkeit, that sense of fellowship and festivity, is practiced across a lot of cultural lines. And so it's been really cool to recognize, of course, that we're all Americans, but we all have diverse origins, and those origins aren't something we should obliterate or deny or throw away. Rather, that we can celebrate them as part of the larger stream of cultural diversity in our place we call home.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was Jim Leary, professor and folklorist at UW-Madison. We also heard from Patrick Curran, executive director for Festivals of Cedarburg. Their Oktoberfest is coming up this weekend. Have you been to an Oktoberfest so far this year? Or do you have plans to check one out? Tell us your favorite part of the event. You can email us. The address is wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Reflecting on the legendary chimpanzee researcher and animal and environmental activist Jane Goodall, who passed away yesterday at age 91 while on a speaking tour.
She spoke at UW-Madison's Memorial Union in 2023 on the value of hope. I interviewed her before that event.
People come to me and say, oh, the problems of the world are so huge and I'm just one person and I'm just feeling helpless and hopeless. And I say, well, don't listen when they say, think globally, act locally. Because if you think globally, you're bound to be depressed. It's a very dark time that we're living in. So think and act locally. Do something to make a difference, whatever you're passionate about.
That is the voice of Jane Goodall speaking here on WPR before an event at UW-Madison in 2023.
You can share your Jane Goodall remembrances. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Rochelle Wilson, and Royce Padezwa.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.